Thank you, Mindy. This afternoon, we are going to deal with this question, the possible problem of masturbation. Since volumes have been written about masturbation, one wonders why still another theologian feels the need to speak about the subject. Is it not presumptuous to believe that one has something new to say about an inveterate tendency of both men and women over the centuries? My response is there is something new to be said on the subject. For example, one's response to new thinking on the matter, or maybe so-called new thinking, as well as one's personal experience in counseling persons struggling with the habit of masturbation. During my 13 years here in New York City, working with homosexual people, this problem frequently comes up. In this endeavor, I've gathered some fresh insights concerning the psychology of masturbation from the study of sexual addiction, of which masturbation is a prime example. I have also been impressed by spiritual support groups which take the habit of masturbation seriously. That was already mentioned this morning, the stalwart stand of Roy, the head of Sexaholics Anonymous, on this issue. This is a welcome change from Ann Landers' theology that masturbation is a form of therapy. Another reason why I attempt to write on the subject or to speak on is that many persons struggling with this weakness do not receive adequate spiritual and moral guidance. In some instances, they are misguided, having been told that if it enhances the performance of the marital act or the homosexual act, or that it's part of the process of recovery from sexual difficulties. It is now well known that the tendency to masturbate is universal, reaching into all the stages of life, from infancy to old age. It is found among children, teenagers, young adults, married folk, the aged, religious, seminarians, priests, etc. Please note that I say the tendency. In diverse ways, many have gained control over the tendency through a spiritual program. Others, however, struggle in the dark, and it's with this group that I speak. I shall begin with the definition of masturbation and then present some psychological considerations. Then I shall review the teaching of the Church on this issue. I shall finish with pastoral suggestions, including elements for a pastoral program, which will help persons trying to overcome what is really a chronic burden. First of all, some psychological considerations. Masturbation is sometimes called self-abuse or onanism, referred to the 38th chapter of Genesis, the spilling of the seed. And in secular textbooks, it is usually called self-pleasuring. When the psychic stimulation takes place during sleep, it has become known as nocturnal pollution. Father Ben de Greschel uses the term masturbation to denote actions that take place in sleep or semi-sleep, or the actions of children in early adolescence, sexual behavior. While he reserves the term auto-eroticism for the activity of older adolescents and adults, who for a variety of reasons are driven in to themselves and find a substitute for real living in this symbolic and intensely frustrating behavior. In the classical article on this subject, written quite a number of years ago by Father Joseph Farrar, the Jesuit, found in the New Catholic Encyclopedia, he describes it as, namely, and I quote directly, the stimulation of these external sexual organs to a point of climax or orgasm by oneself, by movements of the hand or other physical contacts, or by sexually stimulating pictures or imaginations, or by a combination of physical and psychological stimulation. End of quote. In a broader sense, this includes mutual masturbation in which persons touch one another's genitalia. However, Perhaps the most penetrating description of the habit of masturbation is in a letter of C.S. Lewis quoted by Leanne Payne in The Broken Image. "For me, the real evil of masturbation would be that it takes an appetite which in lawful use leads the individual out of himself to complete and correct his own personality in that of another," aspiring to marriage, of course, "and finally in children and even grandchildren, and turns it back, sends it back into the prison of himself or herself, there to keep, in the case of the man, a harem of imaginary brides. And this harem, once admitted, works against his ever getting rid, getting out, and really uniting with a real woman." Notice, into fantasy, out of reality. "But the harem is always accessible, always subservient, calls for no sacrifices or adjustments, and can be endowed with erotic and psychological attractions which no real woman can rival." End of quote from C.S. Lewis. This quotation, obviously, can be applied to women as well as to men, and also to homosexual persons, expressing the meaning of masturbation, basically, as a personal flight from reality into the prison of lust. Factors contributing to the habit of masturbation. Masturbation is a complex phenomenon. The Sacred Congregation for Catholic Education in 1974 pointed out that one of the causes of masturbation was sexual imbalance, and that in education, efforts should be directed rather toward the causes than attacking the problem directly. Indeed, there are many factors implied in the term sexual imbalance, as we shall see. This is a wise approach. We will not understand why a person is burdened with this habit unless we know something about his background. Now, wherever I say his, substitute her. From listening to people, one discerns that loneliness is a prime mover, leading the individual into isolation, fantasy, and masturbation. Loneliness is usually joined with feelings of deep self-hatred and anger. When the real world is harsh and forbidding, one turns to fantasy. When one spends much time in a fantasy world, he becomes enslaved with sexual objects, for that is the way he sees other persons, precisely as objects. Thereafter, he will flee to the unreal but pleasant world of his imagination. This is the beginning of sexual addiction, so well described by Patrick Carnes in his book, Out of the Shadows. So often the habit of masturbation becomes compulsive. That is to say, the person is not able to control masturbatory activity in spite of great efforts to do so. Usually such a person is lacking in insight and needs therapy in conjunction with spiritual direction. Sometimes, however, the habit of masturbation is temporary and circumstantial. For example, as soon as an individual is out of a given environment, the tendency to masturbate disappears. In one environment, a 25-year-old nun was surrounded by older religious with whom there was no real communication. And in the second environment, she was working with religious of her own age during the summertime. She was quick to realize that she was isolated and lonely in the first group and engaged in real relationships in the second. Many other examples could be given where the masturbatory activity is symptomatic of other underlying forces in the person's life. These symptoms, so varied in terms of age, external circumstances of life, and interior dispositions, will be evaluated a little bit later. Suffice it to say at this point that the first step which the priest counselor should take is to listen carefully to the counselee telling his or her story. Obviously, this should be done where there are no long lines outside the confessional, a rare thing in these days. And unfortunately, but rarely, it happens. Preferably should take place in a parish conference room, and only when the counselor perceives that the counselee is spinning his wheels, so to speak, That is, badly needing spiritual guidance. Having said this, I'll come back to these factors a little bit later. Let me deal with the heart of my discussion, the morality of masturbatory activity. Why is it immoral to masturbate? The Declaration on Certain Questions Concerning Sexual Ethics says that the traditional doctrine that masturbation constitutes a grave disorder is often called into doubt or expressly denied today. That's the understatement of the year. A popular college textbook, for example, points out that empiric evidence has changed the attitudes of many concerning masturbation, placing moralists in the awkward position of holding, quote-unquote from the college textbook, virtually every male is guilty of mortal sin. The authors have obviously ignored the distinction between objective gravity, the nature of the sin in itself, and subjective guilt, the amount of responsibility the person has. In their comprehensive review of opinions concerning the morality of masturbation, the authors of Human Sexuality, back in 1977, referred to an emerging consensus which views the moral malice of masturbation as a quote-unquote substantial inversion in order of great importance. Of course, the authors were about to repudiate that consensus a little bit later in the book. Now, let me move on. In regard to Scripture, you're not going to find texts in the Scripture which you can prove conclusively from them that masturbation is wrong. What you have in Holy Scripture are many references to immorality. For example, to the text in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 9, it says, if you cannot contain yourself, marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And burn means if you're engaged in an act of lust. And of course, fornication is lust, and so also is masturbation. So it could be taken from that text. But the general drift of the Scriptures is to say, as St. Paul says often enough, avoid all immorality. And certainly, we can see easily that the sin, that the act of masturbation is a form of immorality because it's a distorted form of sexuality. It is a solo act. And by the nature of human sexuality, it is always meant to go from one person to another, from a man to a woman to a man. It's meant to be an act of union between two people, profoundly social, in no way to regard it as purely solitary. But other scriptural texts you may want to take a look at briefly. I'll say bingo at this point. Galatians 5, verse 23, 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. They're interesting texts, but we don't try theologically to prove the immorality of masturbation by quoting individual scriptural texts. From the general nature of what human sexuality is, as Scripture has established it in many different places, the inevitable conclusion is a solitary act has to be seen as immoral, period. So much for that. Let's get back now to the authors of Human Sexuality. They say there that it's difficult for moralists to continue to hold to the traditional position, which they say seems to be in conflict with common sense. Now, such moralists downplay the issue of the objective gravity of the act, taking refuge in the opinion that on the pastoral level, in many instances, lack of full awareness and lack of full freedom prevents such acts from being morally sinful. Now, we can agree with that. We're talking about the act in itself as being a serious disorder of sexuality. That's all we're saying here. Okay. Now, Father Farrell, who has made all the good distinctions, argues cogently from constant church teaching that masturbation is a serious violation of the moral order if one is fully aware of the malice of the act and does it. It's not just the act, but it's the freedom and awareness with which one does the act, especially the freedom, since it does not fulfill the purposes of union and procreation to which the marital act is ordained according to Holy Scripture, it is a seriously disordered and sinful act. It follows from that idea. Let's move a little further. Farrer also points out that sexual stimulation by a married couple is morally illicit if it leads to natural vaginal intercourse or completes the marital act. Farrer is very exact about what constitutes grave malice in masturbation when he writes, quote, "For a person to be formally guilty of a mortal sin of masturbation, his act must be a fully deliberate choice of what he fully realizes is seriously sinful." I repeat that because that's the heart of the question in most cases. Most people don't argue when they come to you and talk to you about the problem. They admit the act's wrong, but they wonder how responsible they are for the act. See? And that's what we got to look at here. For a person to be formally guilty of a mortal sin of masturbation, his act must be a fully deliberate choice of what he fully realizes is seriously sinful. If such an act is done with only partial realization or partial consent of the will, it is a venial sin. If there is no free choice of the will, there is no guilt of sin at all, even if the person is aware of what he is doing. End of quote. Farrer sounds almost liberal there, doesn't he? All right. Farrer goes on to point out that there is no sin even when a person foresees a sexual stimulation and orgasm will result from some action the person is freely performing, provided he does not intend such stimulation, but merely permits it, and that he has a sufficiently grave reason for doing so. For example, an example I have given past is a young doctor who is unusually stimulating his work with a female patient, but he doesn't know at all intend the masturbation. It takes place against his will. Now, let's move along. Farrer also corrects the misunderstanding that many Catholics have that if they experience sexual stimulation, however unwillingly, they already committed a mortal sin. Among today's generation, I don't believe that many suffer from such guilt. If anything, many are surprised to learn that masturbation is sinful. They've been told all along, you're going to grow out of it. It's merely a natural habit. You're going to grow out of it. You've heard that before, I'm sure. It is necessary then to instruct the faithful with the careful distinctions which Farrer makes so as to avoid anxiety of conscience on people, at the same time to avoid what we have today, a mindless laxism. As in the instance of birth prevention, so also in the question of masturbation, one sees a turning away from official church teaching in 1966, and Father Charles Caron argued that every act of masturbation itself need not be considered as constituting a deordination, which is always necessarily grave. Commenting on Caron's position, the authors of Human Sexuality see it as a significant theological breakthrough. It does not say that masturbation is not sinful or that it may not involve serious sin, only that not every deliberately willed act of masturbation necessarily constitutes the grave matter required for mortal sin. Father Caron says you can deliberately perform act of masturbation and it's not a mortal sin. Caron's position, however, and that of the author's Human Sexuality, is directly contradicted by the teaching of the Vatican Declaration of Sexual Ethics in 1975. I already referred to that. Thus, the Sacred Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith reaffirms the constant teaching of the Church on the objectively grave immorality of masturbation, referring to masturbation as an intrinsically and seriously disordered act. The arguments in favor of the Church's position and the response of Catholic moralists to the major objections against this teaching are summed up in a textbook called Catholic Sexual Ethics by William May, Joe Boyle Jr., and Ronald Lawler. I should like to single out several points made in their arguments. For example, number one, while admitting that certain texts cited as condemning masturbation may have another meaning, such as the one in Genesis about onanism, Genesis 38, and so forth, Holy Scripture does include in its condemnation this is the way they put it, very well done, an irresponsible use of sex. That's what St. Paul's referring to when he says, flee all immorality. And that it would certainly apply to masturbation. The Vatican Declaration says that even if Scripture does not condemn this sin by name, quote unquote, the tradition of the Church has rightly understood it to be condemned in the New Testament when the latter speaks of impurity, unchasteness, and other vices contrary to chastity and to continence. Secondly, the authors of Catholic Sexual Ethics respond well to the objection that the condemnation of masturbation is a form of Manichaeism and Stoicism. In other words, you're not. Stoicism, the idea you're not allowed to express your feelings. That's a general description of it for the time being. On the contrary, those who accept masturbation cannot consistently regard their bodies and sexual activities as integral parts of their own selves. For these acts do not fulfill the basic human goods of mutual self-giving and of procreation, the two basic meanings of human sexuality, mutual self-giving and procreation. Such acts use the body as an instrument of pleasure and are really forms of dualism, which in this context means that the body becomes a thing for the sake of the pleasure of the soul. I repeat that. Dualism means the body becomes a thing for the soul's pleasure. Again, this teaching is not based upon the Stoic premise that the only purpose of sexual intercourse is procreation. The teaching of the Church of the Modern World, paragraphs 47-52, and as well as Humani Vitae, paragraph 12, hold clearly that sexual intercourse in marriage has other purposes, including the expression of mutual love. On the contrary, masturbation serves none of the great goods of marriage. It remains a solo act. Martin Luther called it peccatum contra se, an act against the person. Catholic sexual ethics also responds to the objection that masturbation is not a grave moral disorder in certain circumstances. Adolescence is given as one of the examples. The Church has always acknowledged, and the most traditional theologians like John Ford and Gerald Kelly will say, that circumstances alter cases, and that there are degrees of responsibility in the different kinds of masturbation. But the Church holds firmly that the act of masturbation remains always in the objective order seriously sinful. Rightly, she distinguishes between the objective gravity of the masturbatory act, how grave the act is, and how responsible the person is for performing it. And that's where the distinction must rest. This important distinction, which Farrar elaborates, enables us to hold the traditional position while making allowances for a great variety of mitigating factors which diminish the personal guilt of the masturbator, provided, this is an important proviso, that he is willing to do something about it, to overcome a bad habit, or in some cases, a compulsion. The worst advice that a confessor can give a penitent is to say, well, you can't help it. You can't help it. Don't worry about it. What a view of human nature, of human persons. How pessimistic can you get? It's like saying a person can't do it for himself. Boy, we really got to get away from that kind of stuff. And that's oftentimes the advice given. In my personal experience of 47 years, I've yet to meet a penitent who didn't want to get rid of the habit of masturbation, or continues to deliberately masturbate. Most likely, those who continue the habit deliberately either do not come to confession or do not confess to sin because they've already been brainwashed into the belief that masturbation is not sinful, or at most a venial sin which one need not confess. Now let's go on another point here about Karen's argument that a single act is not gravely sinful. The fallacy in this argument is that it fails to see the primary focus of responsibility is the freely chosen act, not the pattern of behavior which may follow from it. Our moral personality or character is formed by these acts, and if conversion is to take place, it always begins with one freely chosen act, So teaches St. Augustine his Confessions. In practice, authors who hold that masturbation is not grave matter are overawed by statistical studies, which show that the majority of teenage boys and a high percentage of teenage girls masturbate. These studies do not describe the frequency of the masturbation or the state of conscience of the masturbator. They don't take into account the very contemporary phenomena of spiritual support systems whose design, at least in part, is to overcome sexual addictions such as Sexaholics Anonymous and Homosexuals Anonymous, Courage, and so forth. All these groups treat compulsive masturbation as a sexual addiction to be overcome through the practice of the 12 steps adapted to sexual problems. One may also argue against the current thesis from the point of view of the pastor. In practice, one doesn't deal with people involved in a single act of masturbation. Whatever the age of the person, one is concerned with repeated acts, or a habit, or a compulsion. Nor does current thesis take into consideration that deliberate act of impurity tends to repeat itself, leading to the formation of a bad habit, which may eventually become a sexual compulsion. That is to say, a pattern of sexual activity over which the person has no real control despite his best efforts to do so. You have compulsion whenever a person is trying real hard to avoid something and they keep on doing it. That's the easiest descriptive definition I know. The moral question is whether one can be held accountable for knowingly taking the first step into a bad habit. I'm coming back to Karen again. The moral question is whether one can be held accountable for knowingly taking the first step into a bad habit. You know that's what's going to happen. Are we not seriously bound to avoid the beginning of such a habit? Or again, if a single act of deliberate masturbation is not a serious violation of the moral order, it's the second act, the third act, or when does it become serious? You can see I'm reducing Curran's argument to an absurdity. What is to prevent a person from falling into the habit? Very probably he'll not try to avoid the act. He'll easily slip into the habit, which under certain circumstances can become compulsive. I refer you here both to St. Augustine's Confessions and to the Summa of Thomas, which talk about how habits are formed. Enough of that. On the pastoral level, one must make a distinction then between someone who still has control over his activity, say habitually masturbating but can control it, and the compulsive masturbator. The difference, of course, is the question of freedom, where a person has some control over his life, even though he habitually does something, we say he has a bad habit. But when he reaches a stage where he's not able to control it unless he seeks outside help of some sort, such as out of a support group, such as the help of professional therapy, then we're talking about a compulsion. Now, my response to that is that people will say, well, how responsible is a person who is involved in compulsive masturbation? My answer is, I can't tell you. I don't think anybody can tell you. The one basic responsibility of the person who is compulsive is to do something about it, to honestly seek help. Now, even there, if his insight is so clouded, he doesn't know, he can't even recognize the obligation to seek help, we'll leave that to the mercy of God. I'm not going to make any judgment about that individual. But we have to try to see that the whole purpose of support groups and of professional therapy is to help people to get out of the compulsion. And since masturbation is really, in many cases, a form of sexual addiction, confessors should be aware of that. Pastoral counselors and confessors are aware of that. Now, it might be good for us for a moment just to delve a little deeper into this whole notion of a sexual addiction. I like the definition given by John Bradshaw in his book, Healing the Shame That Binds You. I like this definition because it goes right to the heart of the question. He says, sexual addiction may be defined as a pseudo-relationship to a mind-altering sexual experience with destructive effects upon the self, and in some instances, upon others as well. Let's do that again. A pseudo-relationship, out of reality into fantasy, to a mind-altering sexual experience, the orgasm, with destructive effects upon the self, oftentimes not immediately apparent, and in some instances upon others as well. As Patrick Carnes explains it, the addict substitutes a sick relationship to an event or a process for a healthy relationship with others. The addict's relationship with the mind-altering experience becomes central to his life. Carnes stresses the truth that people tend to confuse sexual addiction with pleasurable or frequent sexual activity. The difference is that ordinary people can learn to moderate their sexual behavior, while the addict cannot do so. He has lost the ability to say no because his behavior is part of a cycle of thinking and feeling and acting which he cannot control. Instead of enjoying sex as a self-affirming source of pleasure in marriage, the sex addict uses a relief from pain, as Father Jeffrey is bringing out this morning, or from stress, similar to that the way an alcoholic relies on alcohol. Contrary to love, that's the title of Carnes' second book, Contrary to Love, the obsessional illness transforms sex into the primary need for which all else must be sacrificed, including family, friends, health, safety, and work. Now, without developing all the phases of an addiction, which Carnes and Ann Wilson Schaaf do in their books, suffice it to say there's hope for the compulsive masturbator for several reasons. First of all, he can come to understand he's not a bad person, but one suffering from an illness which can be treated and overcome. As long as he hated himself, considered himself as worthless, that's shame, he believed that he was hopeless, despair. Secondly, with the help of a spiritual director and therapist, he can realize he can overcome this addiction. He will also need the practice of the 12 steps through participation in group support systems, just as mentioned this morning, especially SA. In asserting that there is hope for the compulsive masturbator, I relied not upon mere book knowledge, but upon the experience of sending persons to SA meetings, as well as working with members of Courage in New York City and throughout the country. Improvement in the practice of chastity does not take place overnight. It is a gradual process, sometimes with painful relapses. It demands regular consultation with a spiritual director, heartfelt admission of personal powerlessness, faithful attendance at meetings, utter honesty in talking about the self, and the daily practice of meditation or prayer of the heart. In other words, it's quite a bit of work here, spiritual work. This brings me to an important distinction which the spiritual director should make in counseling the compulsive masturbator, because it will help him to begin to love himself properly. I already, I believe, have touched upon this distinction. The addict must make a distinction between responsibility for his past and responsibility for his present and future actions. As I already said, it's practically impossible to make an accurate moral evaluation of the past behavior of the person. We have no way of doing that. But he can do something about the present and about the future. He can take some steps at the present moment, and that's what we're terribly interested in seeing the person do. Now, another point that should be made and is this. This whole problem of compulsive masturbation is concerned with the way the human heart and mind constantly move from reality into fantasy and back into reality again. The masturbator gets into this unreality, into this fantasy world, and when he gets in that fantasy world, he really loses true freedom of choice. His mind concentrates on one thing only. Briefly, Carnes describes it in four steps, like a cycle. That's like the take the hand of a clock. And first of all, there's preoccupation. Something goes wrong in the real world. You begin to move out of it. And the first step is preoccupation with what you intend to do. The second step is you move towards some kind of ritualistic activity. Perhaps it's pornography one years, late night cable television, or you go someplace where this leads you closer to the act. Then comes the acting out. In the case of masturbation, simply a masturbatory act. Other cases could be a homosexual act. And then back after the fourth step is shame and guilt. And by shame I mean the sense, let me put it in ordinary language, I am no damn good, I'm worthless. That shame you can't live with. No one can live with shame or with guilt. And what do? You can't stay there. You move out of it, you go right back into the fantasy of preoccupation with a future act of the same kind. That's your vicious circle, and that's the fantasy world. We have to break out of that, and that is what we need to do. And with regard to that, one needs to keep in mind that one may not be responsible for the past, one is responsible for what one is doing now. And in this particular regard, it's necessary, it's a very important step, that a person be completely honest with himself. Let me put it this way. As the compulsive masturbator practices 12 steps, he recognizes the latent insincerity, notice I use that word, the latent insincerity on the surface, you see, I tried my best to get away from it. Did you really? And desire for sexual satisfaction in his previous protestations, they really didn't want to do it. Part of healing is becoming more honest with regard to one's motivations. The following poem says it all. It's called Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters by Portia Nelson. I use this in New York already, you New Yorkers. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe it. I am in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. We're all good at kidding ourselves, in different fields, different way. I mean, rationalization is part of our life. I remember once when I was a very young student at the University of Pennsylvania, I read a definition of rationalization, which I thought was very good. It was this: rationalization is a purely verbal defense of your way of behavior. Anyhow, let's get a little bit further with this now. On the passable level then, it serves no useful purpose to speculate how responsible was the compulsive masturbator for the past. It is best to help him to set up a spiritual program in the present. The question is whether the addict will use the known means to control his behavior. It is time now to consider in more detail some passable approaches to the problem of masturbation. For a few moments, I'm going to mention some of the false approaches, which I hear over and over again. The most blatantly misleading approach is the attitude that teenagers will grow out of it. What a cop-out. They don't, many of them. Many do not. Another myth is that if one practices masturbation, he is less likely to act out with another person of the other or same sex. I've heard that many times. That may be true in some instances, but in the experience of others, masturbation prepared them to act out. They weren't satisfied with the fantasy life. They want the real thing, quote unquote. In some situations, masturbation has been recommended as a means of relieving bodily tensions, like a form of sex therapy. Other therapists use masturbation, like pansexual abreaction was used years ago, an allegedly therapeutic way of reliving traumatic experiences of sex during childhood. This approach is no longer used by reputable therapists. Mutual masturbation has been used by homosexuals as safe sex. Still other counselors minimize the problem, giving no advice except don't worry about it. Indeed, many counselors and priests, teachers of religion or Catholic schools, regard even the habit of masturbation as a non-issue, or perhaps as a purely psychological problem. And so it goes. I remember years ago, 1979, I gave a class on masturbation at Princeton Theological Seminary. I was teaching there. It was a snowy day, and only half the class showed up. And so I was told to teach anyway, so I did. It was a talk at the seminary that he talked about that subject, which was a non-issue. Okay, let's move along. I want to give some spiritual directives. I'm going to watch my time here. I believe the following directives will be helpful. Help the person to reflect upon the meaning of his life, his hopes, his accomplishments, his disappointments, his frustrations, his loneliness. Try to find out what is eating him. Since masturbation is often symptomatic of restlessness in the soul, and we need to attack the problem. It's been known in the case of working with seminarians that when a fellow gets into a habit of masturbation, oftentimes it could be that he really does not have a vocation to the religious life or the priesthood, and this is symptomatic of that. I'm not saying that's the only interpretation, but it is one of the interpretations that has turned out to be true. Number two, if he is drifting, provide him with a spiritual plan of life, like such as one I've written for homosexual persons, a spiritual plan to redirect one's life, which the Daughters of St. Paul publicized. By the way, they also published a translation of it, and I recommend you look at all the stuff they have out there. Thirdly, make him aware that most humans have a tendency to move into pleasant worlds of fantasy when reality becomes harsh and bleak, and masturbation often flows out of sexual fantasy. The spiritual strategy is learning how to bring oneself back from sexual fantasy into reality as soon as one notes that he's involved in sexual fantasy. One technique which works with some is to make a short prayer and then do something external and physical, such as work around the house, taking a walk. Dr. Kinane used to talk about a lesbian woman trying to overcome temptations who would scrub the bathroom floor or clean the house when she found herself getting into the fantasy world. Have you ever noticed in moments of some kind of fantasy, whether it be anger or jealousy or sex, and the telephone rings, and a person answers the phone, and the fantasy fades away? What has happened is the person is in reality and out of fantasy, and bringing the person back to reality is part of the spiritual strategy. Fourthly, besides sharing your difficulty with the spiritual director, try to find a support group like SA or Courage and talk about the issue. Compulsive and habitual masturbators have found real friendships through these meetings. The cultivation of real relationships with real people significantly reduces the power of sexual fantasy, will give one a sense of his own self-worth. Now, with regard to homosexual persons as such, several points should be made. Notice that this is a general human tendency from childhood to old age, affecting all kinds of people, you know. That's the first thing. regarding homosexual persons. First, one should examine the kind of fantasy which leads to masturbation in the person who has reason to believe that he's homosexual. Is the fantasy concerning children or teenagers? Does it have sadomasochistic images, like being beaten by the other person or inflicting injury on the other? If so, the person needs professional therapy now. Secondly, if the individual considers himself or herself bisexual, because one has had sexual experience with both sexes, one should help. He'll receive help by reflecting upon the patterns of fantasy. If the fantasy is primarily of a heterosexual nature, chances are the person is predominantly heterosexual in orientation. If, on the other hand, fantasy is predominantly homosexual in nature, it is likely at this point in development he is fixated in a homosexual orientation. I wouldn't even say fixated, he's simply in that orientation. I qualify my position here because teenagers who fantasize about persons of the same sex may move out of this kind of fantasy in the course of their maturation, particularly with the help of therapy. I believe that homosexual persons have more difficulty with masturbation than heterosexual persons, for the very simple reason that I believe homosexual persons have more difficulty with the practice of chastity than heterosexual persons. And the reason for that is the restricted choice that they have within the moral order. If one discovers one has homosexual orientation and may not express in a gentle way, the only moral choice is sexual abstinence. I'm told on the condition he's not able to change his orientation. That's his only choice. In the case of the heterosexual person, he has more options. He has the option of relating to the other sex and preparing for marriage and be able to express his genital sexuality in marriage. So I think there are more difficulties for the homosexual person. Not only that difficulty, but oftentimes when a person is not able to tell others his orientation, especially true of the late teenage person with homosexual tendencies, early adult, and he's not able to talk to others about it, and he finds himself lonely and within himself, the world of fantasy is going to become much stronger in him. And so he's going to have more difficulty. I'm not saying he can't overcome the difficulty. I'm just saying he has more difficulties here. And I believe for that reason we have to be more understanding and try to understand the problem and at least do the best we can to help the person with it. And I would say further, because I want to bring this to a conclusion, we'll skip a lot of stuff, I want to say this, that people need to be patient. You get a person who has been doing very well. I've seen this happen so often. And they're doing very well on a plateau of chastity and doing very well. And something happens, usually some emotional thing comes up, some rejection, something harsh that hits them, and they masturbate. And they think, it's all lost. I'm back to square one again. I haven't made any progress. That's where they need help. Oftentimes, right after that, they masturbate three or four more times in a row. They get into a kind of moral despair. People have to be patient with themselves and recognize that corresponding with God's grace, but it may take time. And also, I think they need to recognize that, you know, when they're half awake or half asleep, they're not fully responsible for what happens. That my great moral teacher, Father Francis Cannell, used to say that the human will is the first faculty to fall asleep at night and the last one to wake up in the morning. And I think that's very pertinent to this question, that people who are ordinarily not going to give in to this temptation, get through the whole day without it, busy, work, and then when they try to sleep at night, perhaps a night of sleeplessness or worry or anxiety, these temptations come, they fight them, despite their best efforts, masturbation takes place, and they say, I'm fully responsible, I'm back to square one. No way. When the will is not really able to exercise itself, you can't talk about full moral responsibility. Now I'm going to skip over some of this other material, which is more of an abstract nature. The theories of William Craft, who's a very good clinical psychologist, who holds, for example, that, I'll just briefly summarize this idea, that the habit of masturbation prevents one from growing spiritually. He thought about deliberate indulgence in masturbation as a direct block for spiritual growth. I think that's a very good point which he makes. In his article appearing in the Human Development in the summer 1982, it's called Psycho-Spiritual Effects of Masturbation. It's a very good article, and I'm just going to skip over it, but he makes that point very, very clearly. And I think I'll come to my conclusion. Here it is. The habit or compulsion of masturbation is a neglected problem in the pastoral ministry of the church in America. The view that it is not a serious problem ignores the data of serious spiritual directors and of counselors. Counselors in the areas of drug and sexual addiction insist that their clients should seek to get rid of this habit which fosters self-indulgence. Dr. Kraft views it as a serious impediment to true sexual and spiritual integration. He claims that you as a person are not truly integrated as long as you're involved in the habitual practice of masturbation. It is time then that we, confessors and spiritual directors and counselors, learn from our secular professional colleagues and add to it the wisdom of the teaching of our church. Thank you.